This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. My personal favorite five-syllable word is back in the headlines again. Volatility. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 7th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Volatility all over the place today, most particularly, of course, in stocks. But allow me, if I might, to direct your attention to bonds. I know, right? Boring? Well, yeah, a little bit. But here's the deal. And at the risk of repeating myself, you really want to know where the economy is going? Look at bonds. And boy, has it been busy over there. Investors have been moving away from risk, out of stocks primarily, into the relative safety of government bonds, so much so that the U.S. 10-year Treasury note was near a 3-year low at one point today. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going with what bonds are telling us.
Basically, it's telling us that investors are more than a little nervous about what lies ahead for the global economy. Vincent Reinhart is chief economist at BNY Mellon.
Right now, it's a bit of a panic.
He used the P word. But for the record, he thinks investors are overreacting a little bit.
Investors are very concerned about the global economic expansion because of the ongoing trade dispute. They also expect central banks around the world to lower interest rates.
That expectation and the increased demand for bonds, it's pushed bond prices up and yields down, especially for longer-term bonds. Normally, borrowing for a long time costs more than borrowing for a short time. But that's not the case with some bonds right now, as investors look for a safe place to park their money for a while. And this is something of a warning sign, says Guy Labat, chief fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott.
In my experience, the signals that are being sent loud and clear suggest that the U.S. economy will face a slowdown at some point in the next year.
Thing is, what the bond market predicts doesn't always come to be, says Kathy Jones, chief fixed income strategist at Charles Schwab. But still, that warning it's giving?
Yeah, I think the severity has moved up from yellow towards kind of flashing red lately as the trade war rhetoric and actions have picked up recently.
And investors are seeking safe harbor. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
This has not been a slow summer on the economic front. As Tracy was just telling us, the bond market has been interesting. There was a rash overnight of central banks cutting interest rates to juice their economies, a la the Federal Reserve here. The stock market tanked this week, then it untanked, then it re-tanked this morning before it untanked again. There's global slowing, business unease, none of them promising economic signs. So from Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, some recession early indicators.
Talk to a bunch of economists and business owners, like I did over the past 24 hours, and you hear a fair amount of worry. Not panic head for the exit stuff, just a sense of unease. Randy Delwo runs a small company that makes scientific instruments in Bend, Oregon.
Things are slowing down, in particular international sales to Europe and particularly China.
Jamie Moorhead owns a pottery business in Orlando. You can take a class, make your own coffee mug.
Some things worry me. In the retail side, it's not as good as last year.
Moorhead thinks the job market's gotten worse, too. The part-time entry-level jobs she offers are attracting more overqualified college grads. What Moorhead and Delwo are seeing in their businesses fits the economic big picture right now, says Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics. The U.S. economy is still growing.
Although the rate of growth has slowed quite sharply from this time last year, and all indications are that it will continue to slow, and recession risks are now high and rising.
Zandi puts the chance of recession in the next 6 to 12 months at better than 50-50. Here are the signs he sees. Exports and manufacturing are down sharply, so is business spending on facilities and equipment. And there's the very real prospect that the ongoing trade war will make everything worse, leading to layoffs, driving up consumer prices. But despite all the recent unnerving news and market gyrations, for workers and consumers, the U.S. economy is still doing okay overall. Job creation and hiring have slowed moderately, but are still solid, says Nick Bunker at the Indeed Hiring Lab.
Right now, I don't see any indication the U.S. labor market is in recession or necessarily pointing towards one.
What would raise serious worries that a recession is upon us? A sharp uptick in unemployment. Consumers getting the jitters from layoffs or higher prices from tariffs and pulling back on spending for back to school and the holidays. Then we could be in for a pretty tough 2020. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, 589 was the down number on the Dow this morning, off 22 at the close. Don't even get me started on bond yields, would you? Volatility, am I right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Part of the debate about immigration, specifically refugees, and this goes for everywhere that people seeking refuge wind up, not just here. But part of the debate is what those people might need as they find their footing. Jobs, assistance programs, language lessons, healthcare as well. That's the stereotypical list, right? But a charity over in the UK, the Entrepreneurial Refugee Network, TERN, it's called, T-E-R-N, holds that that negative perception overlooks the huge contributions refugees could be making as budding entrepreneurs. From Bristol, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on that one.
Good afternoon, Primary Care.
This home care agency in Bristol was born out of a savage civil war. The co-owner, Muna Abdi, fled strife-torn Somaliland as a teenager in 1989, arriving in Britain with nothing except one of the key characteristics of the entrepreneur.
You have to have a thick skin to go through stuff.
As a refugee, you have to have a thick skin.
Yeah, you have to have a thick skin. And that's what refugee gives you.
It wasn't only the flight from Somaliland that toughened her up. She had to endure the taunts of her schoolmates here in England who made her feel ashamed for being a refugee. Today, with her business thriving, with a staff of 70, she brims with self-confidence. You're not ashamed of being a refugee today.
No, thank God. I love being a refugee now because it makes me who I am. You became more resilient. Those struggles you've been through and nobody else did makes you, you're stronger than anybody else.
More than 140,000 refugees arrived in Britain over the past decade. For many, setting up a business could also deliver them from poverty and segregation. That's certainly the view of this man.
My name is Frederick Kastner. I'm a co-founder and director of TERN, the Entrepreneurial Refugee Network.
He helps refugees develop their business ideas.
Our key message is that refugees thrive when they have self-reliance, self-determination, and when they can contribute to society.
Well-paid employment is not always open to refugees, he says. Often their qualifications aren't recognised. Too often they're left to languish on welfare. If only 6,000 of them started a business here, the British government would save a fortune.
You're looking at about £400 million that could be saved, getting people off welfare, increasing earnings and also creating wealth and employment for others.
His group has so far helped more than 150 refugee entrepreneurs, people from all walks of life.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the international comedian, Usman Khalid!
Usman Khalid, who fled the threat of religious persecution in Pakistan, now ekes out a living here in various part-time roles, including that of stand-up comedian.
Fortunately for me that they are paying me for this, and unfortunately for you, because it's your money.
His humor may be an acquired taste, but as for the product he recently launched, that's a different matter. Khalid has developed his own brand of organic coffee, which he sells from a market stall and at special events across the capital.
One flat white and one cappuccino. Yeah. There is nothing else in the world better than to be your own boss.
In a nod to his refugee status, he's called his coffee Haven and promised that when it starts to make a profit, he'll plough money into training other refugees as baristas.
Through that skill, they can get into the job market, and through getting into the job market, become integrated into UK society.
The refugees' motives are often mixed, altruism entwined with self-interest. Take Amina Kadogo from the Congo. She set up a small property rental firm here, partly to support an orphanage back home and to prove to the Brits she's not a burden.
If you can pay for your own bills and contribute, it's a way of earning respect.
But she cheerfully admits she's a terrific sucker for branded goods and once lived on bread and tea for a couple of weeks so she could afford a pair of designer booties.
I love nice things, and I think that's a big drive of, you know, me getting into business, is so I can buy nice things for myself.
She's going to fit right in to Britain's consumer economy. That's real integration. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There was word from FedEx today that it's not going to renew its ground delivery contract with Amazon, choosing instead to focus on the broader e-commerce market. It's a gutsy move, right? Betting that the rest of the online shopping economy is going to generate enough shipping business to make up for cutting Jeff Bezos loose. Marketplace's Jack Stewart has been looking into that one.
Back in May, FedEx made news by announcing regular Sunday deliveries. At the time, President and COO Raj Subramaniam told me he's thinking beyond that one prime client in Seattle.
E-commerce is much larger than any one company. Our customers are small customers, medium customers, large retailers, you know, Walgreens and Walmarts and Targets. We offer the service to everybody.
FedEx said that Amazon made up 1.3% of its revenue in 2018. Less than you might think, right? Especially when we hear so much about Amazon dominating the market. FedEx likely wasn't making much profit anyway, says Gordon Glazer from Shipaware, because of Amazon's outsized influence.
They're an 800-pound gorilla, and they dictate, you know, what they're going to pay pretty much.
He says this is all likely good news for other e-commerce companies. FedEx will have open capacity now. And there are definitely new opportunities out there, says Denise Dalhoff at the conference board. For example, peer-to-peer sales.
Platforms like Poshmark or secondhand websites like ThredUp or The RealReal, all that is just increasing e-commerce, and with that, the business for shipping companies.
Amazon will be fine. It's investing in its own delivery capacity, including hubs, planes, and trucks, and at a faster rate than sales are growing, according to Moody's research. Analyst Anthony Chocomba says that's another reason for FedEx to get out.
FedEx is realizing that Amazon is becoming a competitor.
And sometimes the smart move is to walk away from a fight. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, I mean, I don't enjoy being human cargo, which is most of my job.
Life in the music business. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrials fell a modest 22 points today, basically flat, 26,007. The NASDAQ rose 29 points, 0.3%, 78.62. The S&P 500 found 2 points in the couch cushions, pretty much unchanged, 28.83. Told you about FedEx and Amazon. FedEx down 0.3% today. Amazon and UPS both picked up that same 0.3%. In entertainment, Disney says it plans to bundle its streaming services, charge a monthly fee of about $13. That's competitive with the most popular plan offered by Netflix. So let the fight for subscribers begin. Disney declined 4.9% today. Netflix off 1.8%. That Disney decline, by the way, was earnings yesterday, is what that was. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note also a little volatile. It fell early in the day, but then landed back at about the same place as yesterday, 1.71% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We are just about at, or in some places already past, I think, the first day of school, which means we are also in the window for back-to-school shopping and those annual back-to-school sales tax holidays you see in a lot of states, 15 states to be precise, where you can buy things like pencils and backpacks and calculators tax-free. Politicians and retailers say they're good for sales and that they save people money. Would that it were that simple, as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
Last Friday, Virginia kicked off its three-day back-to-school sales tax holiday. So Amy Lewis took her son shopping.
That is exactly what drew me out. This is our first year of elementary school, and we want to take advantage of all the school supplies we need. Notebooks, crayons, glue, lots and lots of tissues and baby wipes.
States have been holding back-to-school sales tax holidays for decades for two main reasons. One, boost the economy. State officials say if you give people a temporary tax break, they'll spend more at local retailers. And not just on school supplies.
They think that even if you're buying these discounted products that, oh, maybe you'll end up buying other things as well.
Janelle Kaminga is a policy analyst at the Tax Foundation. She says studies done in states with sales tax holidays have found this isn't the case.
What actually happens is that people are just buying what they're going to buy anyway. They just shift when they shop. So there's no actual economic increase.
There's just a tax loss. Case in point, Amy Lewis from Virginia. Even though she saved about $30 in sales tax, she says she stuck to her shopping list.
We didn't really buy anything that wasn't required.
The other reason states give for holding back-to-school tax holidays, they make it cheaper for families to buy school supplies. And that's true. In Virginia, people are saving between 5.3% and 7% in sales taxes. But Annette Nellen, a tax professor at San Jose State University, says states should think about which families really need the help.
Who is it that is struggling to buy any of these items? And I'm guessing, you know, if it's a wealthy family, they're probably not even thinking about the cost of these school supplies. And now you're giving them a tax break they don't need.
She says states forego millions of dollars in tax revenue during these sales tax holidays, and they could give that kind of money directly to the families that need it instead. Aubrey Lane, the Secretary of Finance for the Commonwealth of Virginia, agrees that there would be more targeted ways to help low-income residents. And as far as economic stimulus?
We have no real good data that shows that this has increased sales at all. It's probably just a transfer of sales from another period.
But Lane says Virginia has had a sales tax holiday for almost 15 years. It's a tradition, and people have come to expect it.
Anytime you take anything away, particularly seen as a benefit, it's difficult for politicians to do that. So I don't see it being abated anytime soon here in the Commonwealth.
especially, he says, because it costs Virginia only about $7 million a year in tax revenue. The Commonwealth brings in about $21 billion in total. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Ben Folds has been around the music industry for a long time now, and for most of those 25 or so years, either with his band, Ben Folds 5, or later as a solo artist, his work was telling us what was going on in his life. At some point, though, his music became more about what was going on around him. That change and stories of his life in the music business are told in his new memoir. It's called A Dream About Lightning Bugs. Ben Folds, it's good to have you on.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So this is going to sound a little weird, but I'm just going to dive right in with it. You have wanted to be a musician, you say in this book, since like before you could walk, right? Mm. And so the opening question is, now that you've made it as a musician, is it what you thought it would be?
I'm not happy. No. It's you know, making an occupation out of it is not, you know, that was not what I expected. You know, like the amount of work was surprising to me. Yeah. I didn't know I was going to have to work.
Say more about that, actually.
Well, I think when you make, you know, there are – I've done a lot of thinking about something actually William Shatner was like to talk about, which is the difference between an amateur and a professional. That, you know, in his estimation, an amateur is – likely more talented in many cases than a professional, but a professional can do it at 8 o'clock or whatever time you're supposed to.
Right, right.
You know, so you can do it on the schedule, and you know, like even schedules of album making in the '90s when we started making albums, when I started making albums, you know, wow, it's like, okay, your deadline's here. All the songs have to be recorded by this time, and you go back out on tour. But I found I liked that. I liked the pressure of. I don't enjoy it, but I'm happy for the pressure to do things and complete them.
When you're in the mix of making the albums or on tour or you know, whatever project you've got going on, are you loving it, or are you grinding it out so that you can get out there and do your thing in front of audiences?
Well, I mean, I don't enjoy being human cargo, which is most of my job, and. I don't know. That's a difficult question to answer. I mean, I am who I'm supposed to be, I feel, when I'm playing music. And that doesn't mean that I'm happy with myself at that moment or happy with even the music. But there is something about being who you're supposed to be. Like the existential part of it is I feel like myself when I'm making music. It's something that I feel more or less in control of, or maybe I don't feel the need to be in control of it. I don't know what it is.
Well, so, but being yourself actually gets to sort of what I took away from this book. And look, I've listened to your music, but I don't know you from Adam, right? But you read this book, right. and you come off as a little angsty.
Really?
Yeah, you kind of do.
Well,
no,
there you go. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. I didn't really think about how I came across in the book. It's funny. I had so many other things in my head. I had this place I wanted to drive it about creativity and about what I sort of, you know, what I finally learned from all the things that I knew about making music, because it always went the other way. Music and ideas about music always stole from my life. And at some point, it got to go the other way. So that's what I was thinking about. And if in the process of it... the Sturm und Drang showed up. That's fine too.
Well, so let me revise and extend my prior remarks, if I could quote from the Congress of the United States, right? and to that point of, you know, mood and driving your music, you talk a lot the last like third-ish of the book about Rockin' the Suburbs, your album that dropped on September 11th, 2001, and you talk about the process of writing that and the national mood. Both during the writing of the album, but also immediately afterward. And clearly that affects you, right? You absorb it and that comes into your music.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting to be, to have sort of a, a voice in the forum. And what I got out of that era was what I found interesting was that something about the suburban audiences that I played for and what I noticed in modern rock radio, which was very angry, like 24/7 anger, loud, white, screaming guy music. It's interesting that that was all coming from and aimed at the suburbs. And at the time, it just seemed odd. You were sort of like, well, I mean, I guess that maybe they're taxed too much. And and it is kind of hard, you know, keeping that whole lawn mowed and everything. Like, you thought about these things that maybe weren't on point. And now later, you know, you can see from the 2016 election that the anger manifests itself in a massive decision. And now we're taking it seriously.
Well, I mean, what do you make then of I mean, you're a middle-aged guy writing pop music here in 2019. What do you make of your environment?
I think the environment's very difficult to write in for a pop musician, because by the time you would speak about something that was, especially if it was political, but it could be anything, the news cycle is so fast and so sensational that by the time you speak about something that is affecting us all, you know, you can't even, you don't even have time to mix it before it's so yesterday. And so that makes it difficult. I think, you know, maybe back in Bob Dylan's time, yes, the times were changing, but at least they were kind of changing on a week news cycle rather than, you know, 3 hours and what's the latest nickname for somebody. And I did a thing for the Washington Post where I ended up writing a song about Rod Rosenstein. Wow. And, you know, what I found, like being forced into writing something sort of political, was that I had to look at the human being inside it. And that is what I found interesting. The government worker, the bureaucrat, the lawyer, I felt like there's not a song right now for those people. There's so many of them that some, you know, they've been demonized, but they go to work and they help make the bureaucratic world go around. I don't want to do it. You know, I don't want to collect garbage either, and I don't want to fix my plumbing, and I don't want to be a bureaucrat. So God bless them.
It's a book called A Dream About Lightning Bugs, A Life of Music, and Cheap Lessons. Ben Foltz wrote it. Ben,
thanks
a lot. I appreciate your time.
Oh, man, thank you very much.
We've got a chapter from Ben's book for you online, marketplace.org. He's talking about what he thinks of pop music today. Check it out. Final note on the way out today, in which the modern digital global economy shows it still relies on the old standbys. Remember, I was talking about safe havens for investors in times of volatility up at the top of the program, government bonds. Tracy did that whole story. Even more safe, gold. Hence this, it topped $1,500 an ounce today, a 6-year high. Also, and not for nothing, Bloomberg reports that China bought 10 tons of gold last month. All right, we're going. Dow Industrial's down 22 points today. Remember, 589 off early in the day. NASDAQ up 29 points, 0.3%. S&P 500, 2 points to the good, percentage-wise unchanged. Our media production team includes Sarah Begair, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.